The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Tuesday, the 25th of February, 2020. On the podcast today, I have Will Rind, who is founder and CEO of Granite Shares, and Will talks about how their ETPs are designed, that's exchange-traded products, are designed to give investors leverage exposure to both the upside and downside of individual UK-listed big cap companies. And some of the companies he talks about are AstraZeneca, BAE Systems, Barclays, Lloyds, Glencore. There's about 11 big companies you can get upside and downside leverage to. They're times three, the leverage, by the way. Also on the podcast, Glenn Goodman, former ITV News business correspondent and now the author of The Crypto Trader, talks about how he's traded the markets this week. Plus, he covers Bitcoin, blockchain, and cryptocurrency news. Plus, as always, I have two lists for you. The top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours and the top five most liked RNSs. And you can see both these lists, top 10 versions of these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk. And by the way, if you did receive an RNS from the Vox Markets app or just popped up on your screen on the website and you like the contents of that RNS, don't forget, hit that thumbs up button. And if it gets enough likes, of course, it will feature in that most liked list at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Want to get live push notification alerts whenever a company you follow releases an RNS? Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Will Rind, founder and CEO of Granite Shares ETFs. Will, thanks for joining me.
Justin, thank you for having me.
This is very interesting. I got this email in and I saw it. I thought, and it took me a couple of seconds to understand what it was about. So first of all, before we get into it, just give us a brief overview of what Granite Shares ETFs are, please, if you could, Will.
Yeah, sure. So Granite Shares, we're an exchange-traded product provider, which means we're specializing in providing ETFs that trade on a stock exchange. Mm-hmm. So we're primarily based, our headquarters in the US, but what we're going to talk about today is our UK business that we most recently launched, where we've launched the first platform of short and leveraged exposures to major UK blue chip shares. So in other words, you can buy or trade three times long a major company like Lloyds Bank or three times short Lloyds Bank on the London Stock Exchange through your average brokerage account.
Wow. So where did the idea for this come from? So I understand we're going to why you did it, but so it was a demand for this or what?
Yeah, so we've done obviously a lot of market research that, you know, at the end of the day was just one supporting thing in terms of doing this. But I think there are kind of a couple of things which led to this. So the first is, you know, I'm a very big believer in, you know, what technology is doing to the industry kind of overall. And, you know, the major kind of impact for, you know, the everyday investor is that there's just empowerment that, you know, hasn't existed before. So be it through technology and access to information, you know, individual investors or investors have more information now than they ever had before. And that's incredibly empowering. It's causing them to take more control of the financial future. The other thing is that, you know, leveraged ETFs or ETPs, they're a huge category. They're already a very, very well-established product set. So about $80 billion globally invested in these types of products. Now, typically, these products historically have provided access to broad indexes. So indexes like FTSE 100, for example. But now what we are doing is expanding that category and innovating to provide for the first time exposure to individual shares. Whereas before, you know, people have had to get that through a margin account or other ways to do that. So making it easier for people to get access to leverage on their favorite shares.
Yeah. So I know a lot of people listening to this podcast are into small cap or even micro cap stocks because there's a potential there to get outsized returns. You know, I mean, they have to put, because I mean, generally the average prime investor doesn't have a big chunk load of money. So with smaller cap stocks, what they're going to do is put less down, but get more of a return. There's more risk, of course. So I suppose what you're doing here is giving them the opportunity to maybe reduce that risk because you're investing in companies that are, you know, have good balance sheets, they're generating cash, but you get the added sort of potential of that leverage, don't you? The move, the bigger reward.
Yeah, that's right. So just to take a practical example, similar to what you were saying with the micro cap or small cap analogy, if you take a major company that we offer exposure to, is like a BP or a Shell, if you put £100 in terms of if you buy £100 worth of shares, you get £300 worth of notional exposure.
Yeah.
So you get exposure to three times the money that you invest. And I guess in terms of investing in big cap stocks tend to be less volatile than smaller cap stocks. And therefore, by offering this embedded leverage on them, that has the ability to generate, you know, excess returns or outsized returns than just buying the stock itself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so how many sort of big stocks do you have available? What's the product list here?
Yeah, so we currently have 11 stocks, so that's 22 ETPs. And obviously for each stock, we have both the correspondent three times long and the three times short. So we offer exposure to major names such as AstraZeneca all the way down to Vodafone. What we're trying to do is give access to not just the most popular names, but also with a bit of sector diversification as well. So you'll find banks in there, telecommunications companies, some industrials. So trying to give a bit of sector exposure for people that want to play the sectors, as well as obviously the most popular names. And obviously the plan will be to expand that offering over time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's very, and can people buy these through normal brokerages and ISAs and all that stuff as well?
Yeah, so some people that trade these leveraged products will be familiar with CFDs. This is a alternative to that. So unlike a CFD where you have to open up a specific account with a broker to do that, these are just securities listed on the London Stock Exchange. You can buy them with a ticker code just through any brokerage account that you have, just like buying the underlying shares themselves. Mm-hmm. So for obviously access to the product list, I'm sure you have it in the show notes, Justin, but people can go to graniteshares.com, our website, and take a look at what we offer.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll put the list on the blog post as well so people can see that. But that's good. And how long have you been, when did you launch this, you said, in the UK?
Yeah, so these are very new. So they launched in November of last year. Mm-hmm. So actually, it was funny enough because it was really almost the exact time as the election was taking place. So, you know, first of all, we tried to sort of get it out with the initial Brexit news, but like all new product development, there were some delays in terms of bringing it to market. So we launched around the time of the election. And, you know, again, I think that this is an opportunity for people that, you know, want to take directional views on the market. And obviously with the volatility, at least starting yesterday in the market, gives people the opportunity to hedge their positions or go outright short or obviously go long in their favorite names.
Yeah, yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, because there's all kinds of potential there, isn't it? Like you say, you know, especially when you see things like yesterday happening. And, you know, generally, if you look at that, I was looking at the stats on markets when they sell off massively and they get oversold, like, you know, 3.5% on the Dow, 1,000 points. Generally, the next day or the next couple of days, you know, you'll see a good bounce. And because some of the best days follow some of the worst days, you know? I mean, it may not be an equal bounce back up, but generally, that oversold nature lends itself to, you know, people buying some stock back up. So yeah, it's quite interesting, isn't it, to get some exposure that way.
Yeah, and also I think again with both the long nature and the short nature, you know, people don't have to be paralyzed on the short side as well. So in a market like yesterday, where, you know, everything's down pre-open, people have the ability to go short and do something about stocks falling or share prices falling, as well as obviously taking a view, like, so that if your view is that the market will bounce back, then you can obviously take advantage of that as well. So I think that's the beauty of the platform, which is that it's really just a trading toolkit. And like any toolkit, you can use that toolkit to manage money better, to manage your portfolio better, however you see it, both on the long and the short side.
Yeah, well, do you know what? I was just talking to an investor on the podcast, and we were discussing that. And essentially, you know, I'm a long investor. I very rarely go short, and you know, my only hedge really is having a gold ETF, you know, pretty much against my, I don't want to sell all my stocks. So it's nice to have another option, because it's almost like looking around, you know, what else, I've spent, you know, probably hours looking for, you know, what goes up when the stock market goes down, you know, that kind of thing. And gold pretty much comes up all the time. And like you said, unless you are a broker or something, or sort of in spread betting, then it's very limited, isn't it? But this gives another option, yeah. I suppose.
Well, that's right. And look, you're not alone, Justin, that there are hundreds of investors like you in the market that are sitting on, you know, whatever particular stocks that they own. And you may not want to sell them for capital gains purposes or for tax reasons, or just because fundamentally you're in the stock for the long run. But that doesn't mean to say that there won't be periods of time when it might be more prudent to hedge that position. When, you know, for example, right now, I mean, who could have foreseen a outbreak such as the coronavirus and the effect that this would have on the market? And obviously, who knows what's going to happen, you know, from here. But I think that this particular virus is probably unlikely to impact stocks in the long run, but short term it's impacting everything. So why not have the ability to hedge that position or some of those stocks for the short run, as well as obviously on the long run?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, do you know what I was saying to that, my guest just on previously? Last week we were saying, I can't believe the markets haven't blinked with this coronavirus. I mean, because there is the, you know, that implication of a financial hit, because second biggest economy in the world, biggest growing economy in the world, you know, it's 17% of GDP, and yet everything's pretty much shut down over there, or 60% of stuff is shut down. And so it was only a matter of time, I suppose, and before you could have taken advantage of the big sell-off, because it was going to happen, you know, and...
That's right. I think the markets probably, or there was some assumption in the markets that it would be contained, and that from a valuation perspective or an earnings perspective, that there would only be a sort of marginal hit. But I think, you know, as it sort of drags on, and you know, it seems like obviously the major news from yesterday was that it spread to Italy, and there was sort of an acceleration of cases outside China. Then you know that brings a larger sort of fear within the markets that it will impact earnings underlying companies, and ultimately that's fundamentally what moves the stock market.
Mm-hmm. Lovely stuff. Well, good to chat to you. I'll put a link to it, and that's of course Granite Shares, and it's graniteshares.com. You can see the list there, and just click the UK version. You can see the list there from AstraZeneca to Vodafone, and there's times three long, times three short. That's very impressive. Well, thanks for coming on, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Just, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Glenn Goodman, the crypto trader. I think that should have been the biggest word on the front of your book, actually, Ben. Ben Goodman. Glenn, so the should have been the biggest word. Really, it's a little bit subtle. Too subtle, you know?
Yeah, but I'm not just a crypto trader.
Oh, he's not just that. No, he's a wonderful partner. He's a lovely person to be with. Just a good egg all round.
But let me
just
say one. Man.
Let me just say one thing. If people want to know the future, right? Listen to the chat that me and Glenn have on a regular basis. Well, what were you saying last week or the week before? We can't believe how the markets are taking coronavirus in their stride. We said that, didn't we? The exact thing. We said, we can't believe this. I don't think people are understanding the potential impact here. And we couldn't understand that the market hadn't blinked, really. And then all of a sudden...
And now it's blinked.
Yeah, you got a couple of deaths in Milan and a couple of in South Korea. But I think it's the European thing that scared people in Italy. And the market's dropped off a cliff. But having said that, if you look at the figures, if you look at my tweets from this morning, I update my spreadsheet, the figures are going down. So, obviously there'll be a lag here, but obviously the epicenter, which was where all the deaths were coming from, Wuhan, that's going down. Yeah. Let me just scroll down so I can find it. So look at this. So daily death toll was 82, the lowest since the 7th of February. Daily cases reported, 589, apart from 512 on the 20th of February. This is the lowest figure since the 25th of January, so a month ago. The lowest figure reported since a month ago, apart from that one thing.
Let me interrupt.
Go on.
because I want to offer a caveat to that, which is, as we spoke about, I think, last week, there's a big difference between the trend of cases in China and the trend of cases outside China. And the cases inside China, even though they are leveling out, as you say, we don't believe a word that the Chinese government are saying. We don't believe the word of local officials who will try and underplay everything. And of course, there people are saying that in China, a lot of, because so many people are basically stuck with in their houses, local officials probably don't even have a clue of half the cases that are occurring inside people's houses where they've been told to remain. Whereas outside China, where we can trust the figures a bit better, it's a very, very different story. And you've still got an exponentially rising trend of cases, more and more every day.
Yeah, but they're not anywhere near, figures-wise, they're not as big as the ones in China. I mean, these are relatively small.
Yeah, these are periphery.
Yeah, but these are periphery deaths. I mean, if anything's actually, and most of them, like I said, this guy died. I saw one yesterday in northern Italy. Was a cancer patient already. So these are people with health complications. I mean,
I'm talking about people in places like Korea and other places in Southeast Asia. That's where most of the new cases are coming.
I just want to make a differentiate between why we talk about this, because someone again came on to me on Twitter saying, well, flu kills a lot more people. I thought, well, hang on a sec, I tweeted about this like 3 weeks ago. I said the reason why I'm highlighting these figures, flu, yes, kills about 50,000-60,000 people a year, but we know about flu, we can deal with it, that's priced in pretty much, it's predictable every year now, the amount of people die from flu is very predictable, we have a vaccine for it. Most people who die from flu have health complications, they're very old, that's most people who die from it. So we know the thing with coronavirus, we don't have a vaccine, we don't know how far reaching this will go and how it'll affect the impact it'll have on the global economy, because China's second biggest economy in the world, fastest biggest growing economy in the world. Like I said, when they had SARS, they were only accounting for 2% of GDP, world GDP. Now they account for like 17% of GDP global growth.
Yeah.
And so it's a bigger problem. And so that's why me and you last don't understand here the potential economic impact. So, but still, though, let me just look at the deaths, because outside
of China, the total number of cases is still only 2,500. But as I say, it's the trend. It's the fact that, you know, since we spoke last week, the number of new cases each day, it has rocketed. It's more than doubled since last week, the number of new cases. In fact,
yeah, but off a low base.
Off a low base, yeah, but as I say, that's how epidemiologists look at these things. They don't necessarily look at, that's a large number of cases, that's rather worrying. They look more at the trend, and if you've got an exponentially rising trend, even from a very low base, that's an extremely worrying thing from the sort of epidemiological point of view. So the question is, will they be able to nip it in the bud? It's hard to say yes, because there are so many different countries now where these cases are coming from.
Let's put it in context, right? Of all the people that have died, we got 2,701 deaths, okay? Now, 2,664 of those are in China, right? So we've got in Iran, there's been 15, there's been 7 in Italy, 1 in Japan, 2 in Hong Kong, one in France, one in the Philippines. So 2,600, it's 98% pretty much in China. And that figure's coming down. So I think the fallout will come down as well. Whether we trust these or not, I think the fallout will come down. I don't think we'll see, as big a rise as we've seen in China as anywhere else. I think it'll just be, I think 7 in Italy is quite big. I said yesterday, listen, I don't think, I think it's a very low probability that it's only isolated to Italy and South Korea. It's going to be, it's quite contagious. So there's going to be other countries, but I think it is petering out anyway. I don't think it'll be as.
I don't like the sound of this, how it's, the aerosol effect, the fact that you can catch it just by, what was it, being in a church? A ton of people caught it.
I've always said religion's dangerous. Religion is dangerous. I've always said that. Stay out of churches.
Now, remember, to roll back to the beginning of our conversation here, the reason I said I'm not just a crypto trader who wrote the book The Crypto Trader, I also trade everything else as well, because that's what I've been mainly focused on the past week, is protecting my portfolio because I've been worried about coronavirus like you, and let's just talk about what the measures I've taken, because people might find it useful. Now, you remember I spoke even a few weeks ago about how I'd taken out portfolio insurance by buying what you call put options, which
not
basically
with direct line.
So I bought put options on a spread bet exchange in order to or spread bet platform in order to hedge my risk against falls in the market. So what that means is, as the market falls, I should be making money. Now, unfortunately, and this is so annoying, you won't believe how annoying this is, but the options that I took out, you know, they're like commodities contracts, so they tend to have an expiry date. So basically, if the market fell to a certain point by February the 20th, then I would start making lots of money. But the market didn't fall by February the 20th. My contracts expired. I lost lots of money on all those contracts, all those insurance premiums, if you will. And then immediately after they expired, the market started falling. It's like perfect timing. But, you know, what I did do at least was take out some more portfolio insurance. I bought the bullet straight after the other ones expired and bought some more. Not as much as last time, annoyingly, but I bought some. And so as the market has fallen, I've been making money on that. I've also been making money on gold. I bought lots of gold and the price has been rocketing, and on US Treasury bonds as well, which is a classic safe haven. And also I'm long the dollar against various other currencies. So and all of those things have been doing well because they're all safe havens. Whenever people run away from falling stocks, they go to the dollar, they go to gold, they go to US Treasury bonds, and arguably, to a small degree, they go to Bitcoin as well. And I say only to a small degree because the price of Bitcoin has not been rising as stocks have been falling in the same way that gold has been rising, say. But what they do have is seemingly no correlation with stocks. And that is a good thing in itself, because if stocks are rising, Bitcoin might be falling or it might be rising. It could go either way. Likewise, if stocks are falling, Bitcoin could go either way. So having some Bitcoin in your portfolio or any other cryptocurrencies at least gives you exposure to something that's not doing the same thing as shares are doing. Yeah. So it's useful in that sense.
Yeah. And
so what I'm saying is I've been doing all right. Yesterday, you know, I lost no money, I think, or hardly any money, even though stocks fell so hard.
Well, the thing is, the value of my portfolio has gone down. I mean, you know, and like the majority of my, I hold about 33% cash. It was a bit higher than that before yesterday because I topped up yesterday on some stocks and on some funds. I hold gold, not enough gold, I know now. But I did the same thing as in timing wise. A lot of it's patience and I, like I said, I bought gold. I started scaling into gold, an ETF of gold. When the gold price, let me just look, it was about literally 1,300. And I had enough of it. It didn't really rise. It was just going sideways for a while. I had enough of it, just got rid of it. And I just wanted more cash for stocks. So I bought some stocks. And then about 2 months later, gold shot up from 1,300 to 1,500. Oh, brilliant. Excellent. But I did start buying in 1,500 range. And it shot up again. So I do go well, but not. I didn't have enough exposure. I've still only got about 2.5% of my portfolio in gold ETF. And do you know what? I've topped up a little bit more today. I genuinely think now, because yesterday it went nuts, the RSI was over 18. I said, listen, if you look back on the chart on gold, and I highlighted it, I did tweet it out, I highlighted it, every time the RSI goes above 80, it tends to have a breather. It doesn't necessarily fall backwards, but it'll go sideways for a while and grind a bit, maybe slightly lower, because in this moment in time, gold is where people want to go, where they put their money, you know, so it won't drastically fall. But I think now,
well, I hope not, because I'm still owning it as well.
Still time to talk.
It's fallen a lot since yesterday.
I bought some today, this morning. But the thing is, gold, I think, is just the start of the move, because what we're going to have is this. If we do have a significant, I think it's all predicted, right? If you look at it, even before coronavirus was around, we knew the existence of it. Look, go back last year, and the yield curve's inverted. Everyone was predicting recession for end of 2020. Now, that's still in people's minds. The yield curve is now inverting again, anyway. And you've got coronavirus, and you've got the trade talks, the China oil trade, all that stuff going on, so knocking the Chinese economy. And I think everything else is starting to get worried now. Italy, for example, in Europe, the response from central banks will be what? To stimulate, you know, to probably reduce interest rates. And that's a good thing for gold, you know, generally. So I just think now this is the start of the gold move. I mean, buy on weakness, yeah, but this is the start of the gold move, I think. I think we could see I hate to put targets out there, but I think it'll break past that 1800 that we last saw, 7 years ago, and it could even head towards 2000, I think. If it starts heading past 1800, 2000 is the next big round figure magnet, and I think it could go to that quite easily.
So are you being too meek here? You should be doing like Bitcoin type predictions. Gold's going to go to a million.
Yeah, exactly. Well, no, I'm happy for like a 10-20% rise in gold, because that all I'm wanting gold to do, it's not going to be the make or break of my portfolio. All I want to do is to edge against the loss I'm going to take in the stocks, you know. I will be topping up on down days or on down weeks, because I think there's a lot more to go, and like you say, it's a very good hedge against equities.
Thing is though, when you hedge as aggressively as I've been doing, for example, so that yesterday I lost virtually no money, even though all my stocks were falling because I was gaining on all those other things. It works out that I might as well just own nothing at all. You know, I might as well just sell everything because I'm basically flat. Yeah. So it doesn't matter if the market goes up or down. It's just, but instead I'm owning all these assets that all just cancel each other out. I guess the point of it is that it's just a massive hassle to liquidate your entire share pool.
Do you know what I did yesterday? I own quite a few stocks. I have about 2.5%, and I've got this sort of risk spreadsheet I've sorted out. And when I first buy stocks, I don't go above 2.5% on them. I try and slow down, because one of my big mistakes was going in too big too early, you know, getting the wrong price pretty much, being over-enthusiastic about a stock I've just discovered and researched, and buying too much too soon. And I realised, actually, you're better off, you know, taking a lot more time to scale in and get, you know, take more news on board, let more news be released. And so what I did last, I mean, five stocks, I'm on about 2.5%. There's good stocks, you know, they're growing, they're profitable companies, growing their cash pile. Now, it took a knock yesterday, and I just topped back up to 2.5% in each of them. Because I'm just thinking, I can, and basically what that is it'll turn back to, you know, positive market. And when it does, I'll own more shares in those companies, but I'll be buying them at a cheaper level. You know, that's also, it's just like the old thing, isn't it? When there's a sale on in the shops, people go and buy. When there's a sale on in the stock market, people panic, you know, and don't and sell, which is odd. Because if you look at when you see a big day like yesterday, a sell-off, like 3.5% in the Dow, which is over 1,000 points, if you look back at history, the best performing days come within 2 or 3 days of the worst performing days. So the bounce does happen. So if you can't...
But just a caveat to that.
It could be grind
also,
low mid-term.
Also, the worst performing days also come within 2 or 3 days of the bad days that you mentioned. So this is the problem, is that you're right. If you sell just because there's been one bad day, you sell all your shares, you could then miss out on a fantastic bounce. But likewise, you could also miss out on a massive plummet that happens straight after, because plummeting shares don't tend to come out of the blue. When the market falls heavily, it tends to fall heavily after 2 or 3 days of sort of medium falls. You know what I mean? So it's like you tend to get a bit of a warning. And if you don't heed that warning, you can lose a lot of money. But likewise, this is the painful thing, is that if you do sell because you don't want to take that risk, then you can end up losing out on the best days.
But in my mind, if you are an investor, you know, you're a trader, right? Maybe you invest in stocks as well. I don't know, but long term.
I hold for a lot longer.
So in my mind, I'm looking at a horizon of, you know, 3 to 5 years, you know, on stocks I'm buying. So that's what I want to hold them for. Ideally, I would just want to hold a stock for 10 years and it'd be a 10 bagger. You know, every stock I hold, I just want to have little maintenance on it. I just want to, you know, put 5-10% of my portfolio worth in one stock and let it 10 bag. That's what I want to do. So, I mean, you know, I don't want to have to chop and change every day. But I think when you have days like that, the market is just mark the whole market down, you know, regardless of what the business is, regardless of how good the business is, how fast it's growing, they mark it all down. I just think that's a one-day sale. You know, and I think if you're not overexposed to a company and you know it's getting better and it's generating cash, I'm not talking about pre-revenue, loss-making stocks, I'm talking about good businesses that actually will be here in 5 years' time in a lot better position than they are right now because they've been growing their profits every year, you know, every quarter pretty much, you know, year in, year out. Now, if you can get a company like that cheaper, do it, you know?
Do you hold, though? I mean, the bit I always find hard, and that's probably my trader mentality coming out, do you hold through the really big months-long drawdowns that happen where you get, you know, like I'm thinking 2011, there was a big one, 2015 to 16, mainly the end of 15, was another big one, and of course in 2018 as well. You know, when you get these huge sort of 10 to 20% falls in the market as a whole, which tend to drag down most stocks, not so much the AIM stocks, I suppose, which tend to do more their own thing, but certainly the larger stocks. When everything gets dragged down like that, but you're investing for the long term, do you tend to hold through those huge drawdowns?
Well, do you know what? My strategy evolves all the time. I've said to people, you know, I've been investing for 20 years. I've learned, even in the last 2 months, I've learned more than the more you sort of. So my strategy has changed. You know, I think going back when the last sell-off happened, I probably would have. In fact, it did. I pretty much liquidated most stuff, and then I started buying Lloyd's Bank massively, and I did very well on that. I held in the last financial crash. I pretty much held about three stocks. Most of my portfolio was in Lloyd's Bank, and I bought it all the way down and bought it all the way back up. But now I wouldn't do that. And so at the moment, I'd see most of them are dividend-paying stocks. I've got funds as well, so I'm quite well diversified. But I hold now 33% cash, you know. If I see any company's performance is deteriorating because of a downturn, then I'll just get rid of it because I don't want to. If a company's still producing good figures and good operational updates, then I'll try and just hold it in there because I just think you can buy it cheaper. And that's when you can really outperform the market by taking advantage of the dips, you know. Because all it is like someone saying to you, you know, let's say in almost guaranteed that gold will be $2,000 say in 10 years time, and someone's saying to you, do you want to buy, you know, several grand's worth of gold at $1,000 now? And you say, wouldn't you, you know? And but there's just that uncertainty that puts people off. So it's almost like if you're going to in a company that's not going to be affected, you know, like today I own a company called Way Education, and they released a trading update, and they said very strong trading update, it's up 13% a day, and I think it was an online educator, right? If anything, the scariness about the coronavirus and all that is going to encourage people to go online and educate themselves online rather than going to classrooms, because schools are incubators of germs, and we're always going to have these virus scares. They're going to happen every 5-10 years, you know. And I think everything's going online anyway. I actually did a video a while back saying, is this company recession proof? And I think that's what I'm looking at. Is this company recession proof? And you know, that kind of thing, you know.
I do take your point, but at the same time, again, playing devil's advocate, as I like to do.
Why can't the devil here? Why are you playing his advocate? What bring the devil here? He never does his own work, does he?
He's not available. No, exactly. He very just busy. Sends me out. I'm his little minion.
Yeah.
He sends out. The gold, you mentioned, you know, if you could buy gold cheaply and you knew it was going to be, you know, that much more, well, not you knew it was going to be that much more, but there was a good chance it would be $2,000 in 10 years' time, you'd buy it, you know, and you've got a point. But for example, the previous massive gold boom, previous to the one in 2012, 2013, was it back in 1979, 1980, when the price spiked up massively to around about $1,000. And, now, I'm imagining if you were there at the time, you would have seen the price spike, you would have seen it fall again, and then you would have bought it as it, let's say it halved in the sort of 6 months or so after the peak in 1980. And many people would go, well, that's a bargain. It's halved in price. It's down to about $500. I'm going to buy it here. Now, if you bought it there thinking, right, okay, well, this is a long-term thing, it will be higher in 10 years' time, you would have waited from 1980 all the way up to 2001 and found that your investment had halved again in that time to $250. So over 20 years, you know, I mean, there's patience and there's patience.
Well, do
you're
know
holding
what?
On for 20 I've got, years just you know, to see your investment halve, you know?
No, I've got, so where would, so listen, this is a new theory of mine, this is a new thing. So let's say I took 2.5% of my portfolio in that, right? Mm. And it went down, halved, So it'd be like then one, everything else being equal in the portfolio, you know, it'd be worth 1.25%. Then you just keep topping up 2.5%, you know? And then when it goes up, if it gets up to the point where it's like 15% of your portfolio, you just sell half. So I say you never top up above 7.5% pretty much on companies. When it gets 15%, you sell half. That's it. So that's an automatic system there of waiting in your portfolio to top up on the dips and to sell on the rises. That's good, isn't it?
I mean, that can work for gold, sure, because
for stocks as well.
Gold we would expect not to go away, but stocks I would disagree, because a lot of stocks just go, you know, they go down and down and down, the company disappears into obscurity.
Oh yeah, rubbish companies, yeah. No, I've got a whole, you know, system of filters that the company has to go through before I even, you know, put it on my watch list.
So it has to have rising profits.
Yes, exactly. It has to have, you know, rising revenue, rising profits. It has to have a certain amount of cash. You know, there's all other things. The market has to be sort of growing as well, the area it's in. So there's a whole, I've got two sets of quality filters it goes through before it even gets to the watch list, you know? And then if it gets that level, of course, things can still go wrong, you know, but it's all about probability, isn't it? As I said, the difference between investing and gambling, in my mind, is that gambling is odds against. With investing, so if you do enough research and you install sort of certain amount of filters, quality filters, then you can sway the odds into your favour. And that's all it's about. It's all about cutting away the losses. So, you know, as long as you can reduce that risk massively, then the reward is still there, you know. And I think, well, that's the difference. Because I always, a mate of mine is a gambler, and he loves to go to Cheltenham watching their horses. I used to go every year for 10 years, about 7 of us used to go. And I used to hate it. I used to hate losing money. I used to hate it. And he said, why do you hate losing money? You understand?
Why did you keep going for 10 years?
Well, exactly. No, just exactly with the mates. But he said to me, but you love the stock market. It's the same thing. I said, it's not the same thing. You know, I said the direction of travel in the stock market on a good company is basically up. You know, I'm betting against 5-to-1 chance of getting his horses running against 10 other horses I don't know about. So even if I research the one horse, I don't know about the other horses. And then, first of all, I'm starting off with 5-to-1 chance against. So every time, you know, I bet on this horse, 5 times it'll lose. So what's the point? That's ridiculous, you know.
Plus, the odds are massively against you.
Plus, I'm drunk
as well. The bookies have swayed the odds, you know, so it's extremely, even if you study form and all the rest of it to the nth degree, you're still very unlikely to make money with horse racing, whereas the odds are not so much against you in investing and trading. That's why it's not, exactly. But when you're investing in stocks, the odds are on because the upward default direction is up over the long term. But also it does have an element of sort of skilled gambling. I've often compared it to professional poker
different gamblings, different kinds of gambling.
When you're trying to manage risk, you know, poker players are all about managing their risk, aren't they? They only play certain hands and they duck out of any hand
that's different to horse gambling, though. I mean, you are in charge pretty much of your hand, and 21's exactly. The same, you know, you can look at the cards and you can see what's been dealt and all that. Anyway, listen, then we've got a couple of minutes. Anything you want to, you know, what's on your mind? Anything massively?
Well, we haven't really talked about Bitcoin, have we? So I'll do that quickly in a few minutes. I sold out of Bitcoin because it was, as you probably saw on my Twitter, because basically the chart was looking very negative. But then it shot back up, so I quickly had to buy it again, but more or less at where I'd sold it. And then it shot back down. Basically, it's been yo-yoing for the past week or so. Mm-hmm. I haven't been. I did buy it again and sell it again, but then I stopped because it was just getting silly. I could have just been in and out and in and out, which I hate doing, and is obviously very costly if you start getting in and out and in and out, shake it all about. So I'm out at the moment and I'm waiting to see what the next move will be. Now, the chart, you know, from a sort of traditional charting point of view, is saying, oh, things are looking bad. It's heading downwards. But I don't know. I'm not convinced. It's hard for me to explain without somebody seeing what I'm seeing in front of my eyes right now. But to me, the chart looks very ambiguous. It doesn't look unambiguously negative at all. So I've still got my finger poised over the buy button. Things suddenly take a nice, quick upward turn, I'll be in there like a shot. But for now, as I say, I'm out just on the sidelines waiting. One quick Bitcoin story that's worth mentioning before I go is some people may have read about it in the paper, the Irish drug dealer who has lost the keys to $56 million in confiscated Bitcoin. He was in prison for drug trafficking. He claims the robbers have taken the keys, the private keys, as we call them. They're basically, you know, code words, like long passwords, have taken those keys to the $56 million in Bitcoin that he'd invested his ill-gotten gains in. And he's not happy about it. He'd printed out the keys onto a piece of paper, which he stored in an aluminium cap of his fishing rod case. $56 million worth of that's $56 million of money, and he's just got the password hidden in his fishing rod case. And then all someone has to do is steal the fishing rod case, which they did, and that's it. He's lost the $56 million. He had no backup, nothing. So the moral of that story is Bitcoin is safe and secure if you look after it properly. Yeah. You don't just like print out one copy of a password and store it in a stupid place like that, or you'll get it nicked. You've got to be careful and have proper security measures, yeah, which I outline in my book, amongst other places.
Yeah, well, if you are a drug dealer for a living, you've got something missing. Let's be honest, there's been a common sense missing, I think, anyway, because let's be honest, the odds are longevity in that career isn't suitable. Yeah. You know, so
it's probably safer in Ireland than it is in some parts of the world to be a drug dealer.
But one thing on the Bitcoin price, I mean, just looking at the moving averages, right? I mean, look at the many times they've gone. If you look now, we've had that golden cross, but if you look at the 200-day moving average, it's starting to come around and flatten out, and it'll be going up. If the price of Bitcoin stays around this level, it'll start going up. Look at the amount of times this happened before. It doesn't happen very often. When it starts to go up, that's positive, you know? And I just think, even look at that. I mean, like I said, I stand by what I said last week. It could come back to like the 9,000 level quite easily, or towards that 200-day moving average a bit. But I think at the moment, it's still looking bullish. You know, short-term.
It is, yeah. Short-term it's volatility. Falling, but not that much. That's the thing. It's fallen over the past week or so, but it's fallen on a very kind of shallow incline. Mm. And that's usually a good sign from a charting point of view. You know, if you get a fall, but the fall is not very steep, then that shows there's still a lot of buying pressure in there. Every time it falls a little bit, a whole new load of buyers come in and buy some more of it. So that's always a good sign that the market sentiment is still vaguely positive.
Marvellous stuff, Glenn. Thanks for that. We'll speak to you next week.
Good. I don't know why I said that.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Phalanx Group. That's FLX, down 2% to 1.225 pence. At four, Providence Resources. That's down 4.5% at 2.65 pence. At three, Amerisa Resources. That's 19 pence and it's flat. At two, Infrastrata, non-mover again, 0.305 pence. And most followed company today is Hurricane Energy. That's up 3.31% to 15.3 pence. Okay, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, it's Talau Energy or Talu Energy half year report. At four, Oracle Power, Thar Block 5 or Block 6 developments. At two, Way Education trading update. It was at three, sorry, three. At two, Kora Gold, further drill results from San Ancora Gold project. And the number one most liked RNS was from Fast Forward Innovations, non-mover day on that RNS. So it's 7.15 pence is the price there. And what's the RNS? It's an investee company. EMAC launches the UK's first operational distance medical cannabis pharmacy in the UK. Very interesting. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.